Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM 103.7. I'm Patricia Cavallari, and in this series we shall be hearing from academics about their research and from students and other members of the campus community about the many activities which will be taking place during the coming year. I'm privileged to have with me today in the studio for University Matters on Campus FM, Professor Roland Littlewood. At this point in the program, I usually provide a short bio of my guests so as to provide listeners with a bit of a background. So I went in search of such a bio on the internet and found a bio sketch from the World Association of Cultural Psychiatry, going back a few years, but I was fascinated by the amazing career trajectory of my guests. I'll just mention a few main milestones. Born in 1947 in an English provincial town, went to grammar school at the time when Latin and Greek was still being taught, didn't last very long. In 1965, he spent 8 months in a Hindu monastery. In 1966, went on to St. Bartholomew's Hospital Medical School for his medical training. He was a house surgeon, physician at Barts, then junior psychiatrist and lecturer. And he followed that up with psychotherapy training, and in 1978 to Oxford to study social anthropology on a postdoctoral research fellowship. His first book was on minority and psychiatry, Aliens and Alienists, and his PhD fieldwork was in Trinidad with a new Africanist religious movement called the Earth People, which I hope we'll be speaking about. In 1982, he was at Guy's Hospital, London, to complete higher psychiatric training. He spent 2 years as a senior lecturer in Birmingham. In 1987, went back to London as a senior lecturer, reader, and now professor of anthropology and psychiatry, working within both the Department of Anthropology and the Department of Mental Health Sciences. I really must mention also his 8 books, which are obviously on intercultural psychotherapy, religion and pathology, and new religious movements, racism and psychiatry, and of course about 150 papers. He also has a DSc, D.Litt and Fellowship of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. A warm welcome to the programme, Professor Littlewood.
Thank you very much.
Well, as we can see from that little potted bio, you've had an interesting, that's a very boring word, really interesting, isn't it? Fascinating, I would say, trajectory in your career. You started off with medical training, but somewhere along the line, you joined the field of psychiatry, and then you went on to anthropology, bringing your psychiatry with you, so to speak. Perhaps you could tell us how that happened, really.
Okay, well, initially I had no interest in anthropology. My brother's a classicist, and he'd studied some of the older texts which he'd lent to me when I was at school, but I found them very fanciful. So I went into medicine intending to study psychiatry, with an emphasis on the psychoanalytical, on Freud and Jung and so on. I found myself as a lecturer in London, working in the East End of London, which is the area of Barts Hospital. And many of my patients came from ethnic minorities. I just became interested in whether diagnosing them accurately, the effects of discrimination, the racism on their mental health. I then realized I knew nothing about their everyday life. Typical doctors, you only see the patient in the clinic. And at that time, I had no West Indian friends. I didn't go to West Indian parties or weddings. So really, I understood nothing about their basic life. So I was trying to measure their pathology, their abnormality, if they were mental, against something I didn't know. So I decided I need to know a lot more about social anthropology, about everyday life of these people. So I started a research project, which we didn't get funded, with some of the London School of Economics, who then suggested that I applied for a research fellowship in social anthropology. At that time in England, if you had a PhD in one subject, you could transfer into anthropology to do another one. They only gave one fellowship a year. So I applied for that and got it. So I went off to Oxford to study basic social anthropology. Given my previous interest in the Caribbean, because many of my patients had initially come from the West Indies, I decided to go to Trinidad, where I had some local contacts. So I just set off there intending to look at ideas on health, mental health and everyday village life. And I stayed there for 2 years.
And was that the time you studied the Earth People?
Yeah, I'll tell you a bit about that. Basically, after about 6 months, I thought I'd found everything I needed to know in the fishing village where I was staying on the north coast of Trinidad. And then I probably didn't know everything. Well, I certainly didn't know everything. I then began to get a bit bored. The cabin's a very easy place for an English person to do field work in because they speak English, shared cultural history of imperialism, and so on. But then I discovered that about 20 miles away in the bush, there's a new cult had started, run by a woman who'd previously been in a mental hospital in Port of Spain, the capital. So I thought, cult, mental illness, that's just up my street. So I got one of the villagers to take me over there and found this is an anti-white group, but what we call in anthropology an Africanist group, so with an emphasis on African nationalism, getting back to so-called tribal roots in Africa and so on. Something totally different from everyday modern life. Well, to my surprise, they accepted me very easily, and I stayed with them for another year.
It surprised me, just reading up a little bit about the Earth People, that it's originated from this Yoruba source in southwest Nigeria, mm-hmm. but it's a fairly modern phenomenon, and yet they picked up on a very ancient and an old kind of religion. I was surprised to see that.
Well, you could argue it's the same as the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century, when the Lutheran and Calvin go back to early sources of Christianity and say everything that's happened in between has become corrupt and is inappropriate. Well, already in Trinidad, there is some African tradition surviving in a cult called Shango, taking the name of one of the Yoruba gods. Some very similar to Santeria, Candomblé, Umbanda, and so on in Cuba and Brazil. So that was existing, and the members of my group had originally been in some contact with that. But they revised the whole thing almost in a sort of new Protestant Reformation.
And how did you find this relationship between pathology and creativity? How did it actually link up in this particular case?
Well, sure enough, I'm a psychiatrist, so when I got to know the group, I took over with me a whole lot of psychiatric questionnaires. So we have this ridiculous situation. It was just sitting around in the hut, smoking cannabis, including myself. We're all naked, so I went naked as the group do themselves. I was administering a psychiatric questionnaire to each of them. Pretty absurd situation. But on the whole, they had no mentors, and indeed the leader of the group, the one who took the name Mother Earth, who was originally psychotic and out of whose mental illness the ideas of the group coalesced, had no medical symptoms at the time I was there, apart from some slight anxiety symptoms. But I talked with her and with her biological family, who had become members of the group, and found out that after she'd been living in the bush along with her husband and children about 5 years before I arrived there. After a couple of twins were born in the bush, she had a psychotic episode, the sort one sometimes gets after childbirth, what in medicine is called puerperal psychosis. So she became psychotic, felt she had unlimited supernatural power, and started burning all their possessions. Family initially were totally appalled. She burnt all their clothes, smashed up their sewing machine, and destroyed everything of modern technology. And after a couple of days, she'd calmed down a bit, and they said to her, "Mother, what on earth were you doing?" And she said, "Well, I felt the spirit of nature enter into me." And after that, she had no more psychotic episodes. But trying to make sense of them in terms of her own thinking, and together with the family, provided the group eventually. So some of her children, she'd originally been born in the capital, Port of Spain, and was now staying in an abandoned cocoa estate on the countryside, 20 miles away from the village where I was. So originally it was just the family there, but still had friends in Port of Spain. So some of them came out to visit her, and found the friends of her sons, found that the family now were going naked, I was saying they were embodying the spirit of original Africa. But instead of saying you're crazy and running back to Port of Spain, Esau said, wow, far out, and settled down and joined the group. So when I was there, about 30 young men had joined the group, and were together with some children and a very few women.
Amazing how it started. Another area of your research in the Caribbean was Haiti. And when one mentions anthropology and religion in the same breath, I suppose the zombie phenomenon rather does spring to mind. I haven't read your books, obviously, on the subject myself, but you wrote an article in, I think, 1997 in the Times Higher Educational Supplement, which outlined some of your experiences concerning this cult. And I found it really interesting. You were looking, obviously, both from the perspective of the anthropologist and the psychiatrist. Perhaps you can recount something of what you found and what your conclusions were about the zombie phenomenon.
Okay, this is purely serendipitous. I didn't have this original idea myself. The Channel 4 asked me to make a film about the zombie phenomenon, which is one, of course, that associates with voodoo, the local religion in Haiti. And luckily for me, the film crew and their colleagues had found a number of zombies who are not difficult to find in southern Haiti. Some becomes known as a zombie, and it's a local radio program about it, gets in the newspapers, all the neighbors know, and so on, everybody comes to visit. So in a way, the zombies were already lined up for me. So all I had to do was sort of go there, interview the zombies in my very bad French Creole, same language as the region spoken in Trinidad, luckily for me, and see whether they actually were meant to, or get their history, discover how they were zombified and so on. The local belief in voodoo is that the sorcerer Hungan has poisoned or killed normally a young person, but then has buried them alive. Well, no, they're seen as being dead, but by using certain poisons, they're put in a state of suspended animation and buried alive. A few days later, a sorcerer gets the coffin out, gives them an antidote, and restores them to something like normal consciousness. It's not completely normal consciousness, because they become zombies of Western zombie films, for instance. In other words, they lack in human agency. They can't make decisions, they don't have consciousness like other people, so in some ways they resemble animals. The story is that then they're set to work on the plantations of the sorcerer, and some of them escape, and they're zombies who people come across. So the zombies I interviewed, but people supposedly escaped from the sorcerer's plantation. So I just interviewed them in, as I say, in Creole, in some detail, and tried to assess them and find out actually what had happened. And of those I saw, quite a number of them had what I thought was a serious mental illness. I had schizophrenia or some organic disease such as a malnutrition which affects brain functioning, or a brain tumour, or fetal alcohol syndrome when the mother of the child is an alcoholic and that damages the baby when they're still in the womb. And so I came to the conclusion that they were probably in most cases mentally ill. But how they got in the state of being identified as zombies? So, the theory I elaborate is something like this. A young person dies suddenly or unexpectedly, normally when they're in their 20s or 30s. Family mourn in a normal way, but wonder about the possibility of zombification. Zombification is a very common belief in the Caribbean. Indeed, it's actually an article of the Haitian Penal Code aimed at zombification, which will give you life imprisonment if you turn anybody into a zombie. So the penal code itself recognizes the condition of a zombie. Well, anyway, about 6 months or some years later, after this person dies, somebody appears in the village who the family, who is still mourning the dead person, think this person resembles their dead relative in some way. So they misidentify this person as the young person who died, and they recognize them as a zombie. They normally do certain tests on them. So if they're, one of my cases, a young man had broken his ankle when playing football before he was zombified. So when the zombie comes back, they look at him and say, oh, I recognize the wound on the ankle there. So in the way people do in other cases of reincarnation, which are also looked at in the Lebanon among the Druze population. So the zombie gets identified by the family and is brought back into a family situation. So it's compassionate in some ways, but because the zombies like to wander away, they're often chained up or put in homemade wooden stocks. And of course, because I have the mental illness, in my explanation, they're not treated for that, and so they have a fairly miserable life.
Quite so.
On the other hand, they're not frightening. The zombie in Western films is some sort of creature walking around like that with his arms out and so on, who is a killer. But zombies in Haiti are not feared. The fear is that you'll be turned into a zombie yourself.
And very unlikely that they have the strength to kill anybody by the sounds of it. Going back to your bio sketch that I found in that newsletter. The bio I used was actually the first part of it, but then you described this fun description, which you, I think, mentioned was placed in your first book, The Earth People. From this fun description, it's obvious that you're interested in the moments which change people's mental patterns and beliefs, those moments for individuals, but also for religions. And I quote briefly here, you said, "I'd wondered how religious and political movements got themselves started, not the routinization and later elaboration, the consolidation of dogmas and hierarchies, but more the chance experiences that become structured and reformed into universal truths, which are independent of human intention." And it always fascinated me in a very amateur way, of course, how religions start off and how they take a grip. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what you've discovered in your research about that kind of thing.
Well, in the invariable rules, I think it's just chance. So my model would be that the whole time people are having psychotic and weird experiences and generally quite ignored. But sometimes these ideas attempt to gel with something, with some concern in society at that particular time, and then they become meaningful. So it's nothing unusual in the initial experience. It's probably the point of the reception. Take the case of Christianity. Christianity, the conventional view now, is the real founder of Christianity is not Jesus, but St. Paul. Jesus was just a wandering, a holy man who maybe practiced miracles and so on, and came out with some extravagant statements about loving your neighbor and so on. There are probably a lot of other people like that. But then one of the people whose job is to persecute him, Paul, has an ecstatic experience when he falls off his horse on the way to Damascus, and he realizes that the man he's been persecuting maybe does have something useful to say. Maybe in his own terms, he's actually the Messiah who Jesus has been looking for. So the point of what happens to St. Paul on his horse, I think is really the start of Christianity, not whatever Jesus was saying. The problem with that explanation is, of course, we know little about these other prophets who are wandering around Palestine at the same time. So they've left no records and so on. So we go for things which vaguely relate to them, the Dead Sea Scrolls and so on, which only partially give us an idea of the flavour of the times. So, in other words, it's a chance. Does the random psychotic experience of the individual, which is probably related to their own personal life, does that actually gel with society at the same time? So one of the things I try to do in the book on the Earth People is to identify the situations in which that might happen. The more obvious one is the idea of desperate times need desperate solutions. And an example of that is, there's a guy in the 17th century who's wandering around London in the 1660s, naked apart from a loincloth, he's wearing a brazier of fire on his head. It's called Solomon Eccles, or Solomon Eagle in some accounts. So someone wanders around London and said, woe, woe to the city of London, you're about to be destroyed by the wrath of God and so on. In other words, sort of, repent, the end of the world is at hand type figure who we see quite often in different societies. Okay, so the children throw stones and mad at him. If he says, oh, go away, Solomon, stop making a nuisance of yourself. But then, a plague strikes London, and the following year, 1666, is the Great Fire of London. And suddenly Solomon becomes a cult figure because he's prophesied doom. So at that time, there's a sort of matching between what people are feeling, how do we make sense of God's wrath, the plague and the fire, but this guy's been telling us about this for years, so maybe he actually knows something. So briefly, Solomon becomes an important figure. A few years later, Christopher Wren and other people start rebuilding London. Plague and the fire are partially forgotten. Solomon still keeps wandering around London, saying, woe, woe to the city of London, who are about to be destroyed. And presumably the population is saying, oh, go on, Solomon, you've been saying that for years. We've heard all that before. And he fades back into obscurity. Now, a situation maybe when somebody who's already influential has a psychotic episode will be described very well by Suetonius in his account of Caligula, the Roman Emperor, in his book, The Twelve Caesars. So Caligula's a rather odd emperor anyway, and as Suetonius describes him as very cruel. He makes his horse a senator of the Senate, so the other senators... Okay, but he's the emperor, we better keep quiet, he'll do what he wants. Okay, but I mean, there are hundreds of senators, so one horse in the parliament doesn't make much difference. But Suetonius tells us when Caligula wanted to make his horse a consul, then everybody decides to disagree. Because there are only two consuls in the early empire. At that point, the Praetorian Guard decided to bump Caligula off. So at that point, they decided it doesn't make any sort of sense. But the certain societies are probably more open to unusual ideas. Another example, we say Quakers in 18th century America. Quakers are, well, at the beginning, were ambivalent about slavery in North America, and probably many Quaker merchants would have society friends, and merchants would actually own slaves. But then independently, two members of a friend's mental hospital, early mental hospital, in about the 1720s, say to the doctors looking after them, Quakers should not have slaves. And given the nature of the Society of Friends and their openness to humanitarian and democratic ideas, it starts the doctor wandering, and he takes the idea on to the quarterly meeting of the Quakers when decisions are made about policy and doctrine, and says, oh, you know, there are two guys in my hospital who are saying we should not own slaves, and somebody else says, well, you know, I think I agree with them. And that idea then spreads to all the Quakers in New England. In a few years, Quakers are not allowed to own slaves, and in fact become the early members of the emancipation movement for slavery. So there's particular times may be open, particular groups can also be open to unusual communications.
Bringing us to the Western Europe of today, mm-hmm. Are you looking into the very modern phenomena that we have in our society? I don't know, things like the phobias and hysterias and fatigue syndromes and post-traumatic stress. I mean, these are all things that we're hearing about every day. Have you had some answers or some questions about these modern phenomena?
Nothing that was covered some more, except to say that any pattern of illness or mental illness or abnormality obviously does connect up with the cultural conditions. So I think eating disorders, for instance, are something about the location of the self in the body, which is a relatively new phenomenon. Originally, we would have thought the body and the mind are very separate, but now the center of the self has become the body. So if we're wise, we'll go off and exercise in the gym, we somehow become our bodies, particularly in the case of women, because of the general sexism of society. So for women, they become their bodies in much more fundamental ways than ever happened before. And one of the things I'm doing here in Malta is was to examine a PhD which I did yesterday from one of your students, who is looking at what is about Maltese or Italian culture, which makes for eating disorders. And she argues that women's attempt to transcend their bodies. And she looks back, as some other people have done, to the situation in the medieval period, and certain nuns like Catherine of Siena, St. Teresa and so on, who were nuns already, would severely diet, in some cases claim not to eat at all for many months, to transcend the body into something more spiritual. That's all a spiritual form in the medieval period. In the modern period, it takes a more medicalized form. Of course, doctors join in and enhance that sort of belief by talking about distorted body imagery and all the other things they've invented.
And one point in that bio sketch, you mentioned that you decided to give up painting. Was that one of your hobbies?
Well, actually, I've got a drawing block in my bag here with me. I hope to do some drawing this afternoon. Well, I went to medical school, I also went to art school at the same time. The consequence, I failed my medical finals for the first time. Medical finals, in England at that time, you could take as many times as you wanted. So if you failed the final exam, it's no hassle, you just wasted time, so you took it the following year. But the study lectures we had were 9 o'clock on 2 days a week, time when I had to be at the art school. So I finished my medical course, I think only having been to one or two or three study lectures. So at the time of the final exam, you sit there in this rather gloomy room, the green base table, of stern elderly surgeons in pinstripe suits facing you, all these horrible things in pots, they call pots in the local jargon. So they'd say to me, "Well, young man, what do you think this is?" It'd be some advanced cancer. It was so advanced it might have been a cancer of anything. The best students were able to recognise it, because they recognised the pot from the medical school museum where they'd been spending their lunch times whilst eating their sandwiches, whilst I, on the contrary, being at the art school, painting away.
So you couldn't recognise them?
I couldn't recognise them at all. So I failed the exam and retook it 6 months later. I haven't spent 6 months in the Pathology Museum trying to learn them all. So I was quite safe, I hope, as the surgeon later. So our doctors had to spend 6 months as surgeons after they qualified.
Well, time has come to an end, unfortunately. Thank you very, very much, Professor Littlewood, for coming to talk to us about your anthropological and psychiatric experiences, your research abroad, and I do hope that you'll have some time for drawing as well while you're here in Malta, and they won't work you too hard.
Thanks for the invitation.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye. Il-program li għadkom kem smajtu kien miġju plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.